The weather forecast is one way in which we've improved upon the human capacity for preparing for disaster. At least now, we know days in advance when the weather can either douse us with water, make fires grow quickly, or just blow down our buildings. Disasters do happen, we know that. But we have a mixed record through history at both disaster preparation and response. The author Neil Ferguson calls us on that in his latest book, Doom: The Politics of Catastrophe. Neil Ferguson is a journalist and historian and prolific author, or in his words on Twitter, an international man of history. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, a Bloomberg columnist, and the author of more than a dozen previous books. Neil visited with us in March of 2018 about his last book, The Square and the Tower. Neil Ferguson, welcome back to The Exchange.
Great to be back with you, Jeffrey.
So let's pick up where we left off with networks and not just the social ones. In disasters, how do human networks, for lack of a better term, feed the fire, in essence?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm glad you mentioned The Square and the Tower, because in some ways, Doom is a kind of sequel to it. The biggest disasters in human history have at least some quality of contagion, broadly defined. So clearly a pandemic is the best example of this, and the worst disasters in terms of loss of life have been pandemics, with the Black Death of the 1340s, probably the worst of all. And that wouldn't really have become such a catastrophe had it not been for the network of trade and pilgrimage that made medieval Europe really quite well connected to Central and East Asia. So when the bubonic plague began to spread westwards from its point of origin in East Asia, kind of got faster the further west it went, because by the time it got to Western Europe, you had a very networked society. But that's not the only example that the book comes up with, because in some ways, part of what you're trying to explain when you look at a really big disaster like a war is also a kind of network effect. How does a conflict that begins, say, in 1914 over Belgium and Serbia become a world war in which millions and millions of men are drawn in from all over the world? That also is a story of networks. And I'll give you one more example, Jeffrey. The biggest climatic disasters up until our time have really been caused by volcanic eruptions, at least in the period of recorded history over the last 4,000 years. And that's a case where the network of the global climate is affected by a single event, a huge volcanic eruption. But if it issues enough sulfates into the atmosphere, the effect can actually be to alter the climate of the globe. So wherever you look, the things that really cause big disasters have some elements of contagion feeding into social networks or other networks.
Well, and then the case in point with volcanoes, I don't want to let that go by without a reference, because there's a recent in geological history, let's say. 1816 was the year without a summer. A lot of places just, it stayed cold all through the year because of the amount of stuff in the air from erupting volcanoes.
That's right. The really extraordinary thing about the world over the last 200 years is that we haven't had a big one. There hasn't been a really, really big volcanic eruption since Tambora, 1815, and that was what led to that tremendously cold period immediately afterwards. It's all about the amount of sulfate aerosol injected into the stratosphere. And the volcanic eruptions of the last 200 years have been really quite small by comparison with some of the monsters of the past. Tambora was relatively recent by comparison with the eruptions of the late 1100s and 1200s, which were really huge. And we just haven't seen volcanic eruptions on that scale in the last couple of centuries. And I like to remind people of this, because there's no particular reason why not. I mean, basically, there's no pattern to this. You couldn't look at the chart of volcanic eruptions over the past 1,000 years and say, oh, we're due a big one. We just don't have any way of knowing. But if there were to be a volcanic eruption on the scale of Tambora or of those 13th century explosions of geological activity, then the conversation about climate would suddenly be very different indeed, because we'd find that that overnight or in a period of days, a really huge volcano can generate enormous climatic effects. Actually, they could be enough to change our conversation from one about global warming to one about global cooling.
Yeah, that's and that is a particularly difficult sort of thing to prepare for. We don't have the kind of reach to do the things in the atmosphere that some people think we do. Let's come back to the concept of contagion, because as the book points out, I mean, you come back to other diseases through history. You mentioned several already. Why, with all of the experience we have then, some of it fairly recent, like with SARS and MERS, did a lot of countries blow it with COVID-19? And who blew it?
Well, in a way, that was one of the questions that prompted me to write Doom, though I want to make it clear that it's a book about disasters in history, with only the last three chapters looking at our own recent public health disaster. I think that the puzzling thing about this is as you say, that we know a heck of a lot more about infectious disease than 14th century Europeans did. In fact, our scientific knowledge is at an all-time high. We had the ability to sequence genetically the new virus almost as soon as it was identified in China. So the question is, why, with all this knowledge, did we not do better? And it's really hard to answer, because on paper, the United States in particular was very well prepared for a pandemic. There was a big 2019 survey published by the Economist Intelligence Unit that said the U.S. is number one for pandemic preparedness in the world, and number two is the United Kingdom. And yet these countries did actually pretty badly relative to a bunch of other countries, not only countries in East Asia, but also some countries in Europe, which essentially have experienced no excess mortality. It's not just Taiwan and South Korea that you've probably heard of. Vietnam has also done remarkably well. And there are countries in Europe that haven't had any excess mortality, Norway, for example, or Denmark. So there's a puzzle, and the book tries to offer an answer to that, which isn't the obvious one. Because I think the obvious one for most people, certainly for most journalists over the last 18 months, has been, well, we had these populist buffoons in power, Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, and that's why we did so badly. That narrative was very widely distributed on both sides of the Atlantic.
But so you were saying that there was some sense abroad in the world that the reason that some countries had been so poor at responding to COVID-19 was because of populist leaders like Donald Trump, like Boris Johnson, and you don't agree.
Well, this is a tricky one, because they made many mistakes, and indeed the book lists Trump's numerous missteps. He grew increasingly reckless, in fact, as 2020 went on, having initially, back in January, seemed to show some awareness of the gravity of the situation. By the end, he was hosting super spreader events in the Rose Garden. It was crazy. And yet, if you tell yourself, we've solved the problem because we've replaced the commander-in-chief with Joe Biden, therefore the next pandemic is going to go much, much better, then I don't think you fully appreciated how badly things went wrong at the systemic level. Because if you ask yourself, what are the things that really led to excess mortality in the U.S. over the last 18 months? It's hard to say that it was specific presidential decisions, no matter how many bad calls Trump made. The CDC's failure to ramp up testing was an obvious major mistake at the beginning. And I don't think you can blame that on Trump. CDC completely failed. In fact, it made it harder to get tests rather than making it easier. Then we didn't really try with contact tracing. We didn't lift a finger, really, to try and make contact tracing effective. Those were the two things that countries like Taiwan and South Korea got very right early on. We didn't do much to protect the vulnerable in elderly care homes. The same is true of most European countries, actually. And we were really bad at enforcing quarantines with travelers. Now, those are the things that seem to me really to have made a big contribution to the rapid spread of the virus across the United States. After that spread had happened, it wasn't actually terribly easy to avoid a significant amount of mortality. And I think we have to face the reality that although Trump made many mistakes, they weren't the crucial mistakes. They weren't the principal reasons for the excess mortality, and that something went wrong at the level of the public health bureaucracy that we need to investigate more thoroughly. Because if we just blame it all on Trump, tempting though it is, we're not going to see what really went wrong, not only at CDC, but in the Department of Health and Human Services. I mean, we have people whose job pandemic preparedness is. It's like their one job. And I think one of the puzzling things as I was writing the story was the realization that the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness, a man named Robert Kadlec, kind of knew back in 2018 that our preparedness was not really going to work terribly well if there was an actual pandemic. So for me, the big challenge is to understand why these elaborate pandemic preparedness plans, 36 pages long in one case, multiple agencies produced them, why they didn't work. Because until we figure that out, I think we're not going to be well prepared for the next disaster, which may not be a pandemic. I mean, whatever form the disaster takes, I think we have to ask ourselves, is our bureaucracy really nimble enough to cope with a disaster? It feels to me, and that's one of the arguments at the tail end of the book, that we've actually got worse at disaster management over the last 20 years when we should have been getting better. And that's kind of counterintuitive.
Well, how much then does the political polarization that rises in that set of 20 years figure in this? A bureaucracy can do so much. At some point, this has to be brought to political leaders who do something with it or don't, or politicize it or don't. And so does paralysis in political systems contribute directly to sloppy disaster response?
Well, it's tempting to say yes, because obviously the United States has been very visibly polarized and bizarrely. Issues of public health, which in the 1950s or even in the 1970s weren't politicized, have become matters of partisan controversy. I mean, go back to the 57-58 Asian flu. Nobody was debating whether a vaccine was a good or bad thing in 57. So I'm tempted to say, yeah, this has to be part of the story. And yet, there are countries that have done just as badly or even worse in managing the pandemic that didn't have this kind of partisan politicization of public health issues. And it's worth reminding ourselves that although the U.S. certainly has had a bad experience, it's by no means the worst. I mean, Latin American countries have significantly higher excess mortality rates than the U.S. The U.S. and the U.K. are kind of in the upper middle range of the table when it comes to per capita mortality, per million mortality, or excess mortality. And so when you look at how, say, Peru experienced this disaster, it's had a terrible experience with extremely high excess mortality. The story there looks different. There wasn't a populist president, and it wasn't as if health policy became extremely politicized. It was just that ultimately the public health system couldn't cope with the very rapid spread of the virus through a population that had really quite a lot of vulnerability, a lot of comorbidity. So I think partisan polarization matters in the sense that it made it harder for state governments as well as national governments to communicate about the virus and the vaccines to the public. But I still don't think we've really got to the bottom of it if we place the blame there.
Neil Ferguson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange once again. His latest book is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. You remind us in the book, Neil, of predictions of doom and endings and apocalypses. I don't know if that's the plural, but in many cultures. Do we, in thinking that the world's going to end in fire or ice or both or something, hasten those endings somehow?
I don't think we do, but we are obsessed with the kind of cataclysmic end. It's one of these extraordinarily powerful ideas that you find in all the great religions in some form or another. Listeners will be familiar with the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. They're just a small part of what the Book of Revelation has to offer as the end time, and you can find very similar nightmare scenarios of the apocalypse in Islam. I think this is a fascinating idea for us even in our more secular age. One of the things that makes the subject of climate change appealing is that you have somebody like Greta Thunberg prophesying the end of the world, and this resonates with us because it's kind of deeply embedded in our subconscious that such a thing could well happen. We're drawn to apocalyptic movies and novels. Science fiction as a genre relies on the fact that we're fascinated by cataclysmic ends. But as I try and suggest in the book, these kinds of terminations of the species or of the planet have been predicted countless times, and here we still are. It's something that the Beyond the Fringe team made fun of in their famous review back in the early 60s.
I was going to ask you how Dudley Moore ended up in this book, but there he is.
He's there. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. I remember listening to this skit when I was a kid on my mother's vinyl recording of the Beyond the Fringe review. And it's very funny because they send up the apocalyptic visionaries. There's the prophet sitting on the hill, Peter Cook, predicting the end of the world. And at the end, they count down. And of course, the world doesn't end. And his final line is, "Oh, well, never mind. Same time next week, lads." So, I mean, I think at a certain level, we need to recognize that the end of the world has been overpredicted. And in reality, we're much more likely to contend with big disasters that kill, well, I mean, in the case of COVID, we're just about 0.05% of the world's population. More will, I'm afraid to say, die in the coming months. But in the end, it's certainly not like the end of the world if that relatively small fraction of the human race is killed in a disaster. So I think that we're really much more concerned, or should be more concerned, with real, plausible, disastrous scenarios. And we need to ask ourselves, how can we manage those better? Because preparing for the end of the world is not a good use of our time.
We have an email from Larry in Arcata, who comes back to the COVID situation and says, "One problem is that the United States was slow to use low-tech solutions like mask wearing. We used the poor excuse that masks were needed in hospitals. It is much easier to manufacture a mask than a new vaccine," says Larry in Arcata.
Yeah, quite right, Larry. And here was one of Trump's many missteps. He blew skeptically off the idea that you needed to wear a mask. But, you know, the mistake had already been made because the public health authorities had decided, because there were shortages, to tell the public they didn't need to wear masks. And then, of course, when they changed that story to actually you do, a lot of credibility had been lost. It's interesting to look at how the Taiwanese handled this. They had a shortage of masks, too. Everybody did at the beginning, pretty much. The Taiwanese made it clear. They said, "Hey, we don't have enough masks, so we need to try and ration them." And they used a website to make sure that masks did go to the right people, the frontline health workers, to begin with. And then, of course, ramped up production. But you're right. I mean, it's a good illustration of the things that went wrong at the beginning that ought not to have gone wrong. Because in the same way that masks are easy to manufacture, so are tests. Getting a test for this virus was not actually that technically difficult. What CDC could have done was to say to, I don't know, the universities and laboratories around the country that had the capacity, get on with it. Just make those tests. But instead they said, no, we're going to monopolize the manufacture of these tests. And then the one that they sent out didn't work. So we had a whole series of fails at the beginning of fairly straightforward stuff that I think can help, if you add them together, explain most of the excess mortality.
Neil Ferguson, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, journalist, historian, author of 16 books. This latest one is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. You can join us as we talk about the human propensity for preparation or not and response to disasters or not. 800-838-3760 on the phone, or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Given the human propensity for negativity bias, you would think we would better imagine disasters. And one of the points you make in the book is that we prepare for the wrong disaster or fight the last war. You know, for example, having everybody take off their shoes long after the last shoe bomber was seen. So, I mean, it seems like what are we lacking here, Neil?
Well, partly it's imagination. It's always much easier to prepare to fight the previous war than to struggle to picture what the next war will be like. And this is a really relevant point to discuss because the war of the future, especially if it's a major war between the U.S. and China, which, as I say in the book, is really becoming more likely by the week, is going to be very different from the wars we've been accustomed to in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's going to involve a really large-scale cyber offensive. And the United States looks to me pretty vulnerable to large-scale cyber attack. Even a bunch of East European criminals could take a major pipeline on the East Coast offline for a period of days with some malware or ransomware. So I think we have to think hard about what the future would be like, and we're not good at that. It's one of the reasons that I encourage readers to join me in reading science fiction. I'm a historian, I know the limits of history. It's not great at telling you what technological discontinuities lie ahead. The people who looked at SARS and MERS in East Asia and said, what if one of these coronaviruses was less deadly but way more contagious? What would that be like? We're asking the right kind of question. I think our public health officials were expecting another influenza pandemic because over the past century or two, that's been the typical form of respiratory pandemic we've had to deal with. And it turned out that actually an influenza playbook was not much good against a coronavirus, that there are fundamental differences between these kinds of virus that I think we underestimated in the West. So there's a very important takeaway here, which is that you have to work hard at thinking about future scenarios, and you mustn't get too wedded to one or two that you find appealing. Because in truth, there's massive uncertainty. We can't really model the future. We can build models of the climate that say in 50 years' time, various terrible things will happen if average temperatures have risen. But there really isn't as much certainty to that exercise as we ourselves would like to believe. In truth, history just loves to throw curveballs at humanity. And you don't get to predict the disaster that you're going to get. You don't know the timing of the next big earthquake that's going to strike our part of the world and the west coast of the United States. We know it's going to happen at some point, because that's what geology tells us. But we have no real inkling about the timing or the scale of the next big earthquake. So I think the key takeaway for me is it's better to be kind of generally paranoid than very specifically prepared for one contingency, because you don't quite know what's going to come at you. The Taiwanese and the South Koreans have good reasons to be generally paranoid. So do the Israelis. And I think that's one reason those countries did relatively well at dealing with COVID. They were kind of ready for all forms of disaster. And in the neighborhoods they occupy, that's understandable. We, I think, had grown complacent. And we were content with 36-page pandemic preparedness plans that we didn't really stress test. We didn't really simulate. I don't remember being involved in a drill for a pandemic. Do you? We weren't, because that's just not how we work.
So in that context, then, and coming back to your statement of a few minutes ago, where you think with war with China becomes more likely by the week, did either we or China gain anything, any advantage over each other through our handling of the pandemic?
Well, there were many people last year who said that China was kind of winning out of all of this, partly because of the speed with which they brought the virus's spread under control in their own borders. It really never went exponential in any province other than Hubei, where Wuhan is located. Of course, because the United States looked to be in a complete mess last year in its handling of the pandemic, as well as in something of a political mess. I think this was a premature conclusion for two reasons, Jeffrey. I mean, number one, in truth, China started this disaster, whether it was a lab leak or not. This originated in Wuhan, and the Chinese authorities bungled it because there was a kind of cover-up that meant that precious weeks were lost when it could have been contained. Moreover, China's attempt to bend the narrative later last year to claim that somehow the virus had originated elsewhere or that Americans had brought it to Wuhan, I think that backfired terribly. Their whole strategy of wolf warrior diplomacy ended up losing friends and alienating people. Meanwhile, the United States, for all the many mistakes that we made in the course of 2020, got the one big thing right that you really need to get right in a pandemic, and that was vaccination. An Operation Warp Speed, the breakthroughs that had been made at Moderna, as well as at BioNTech, the company that Pfizer works with, these were the things that really saved the day, not only for the U.S., but for the Western world generally. And so now, I mean, it's nearly a year since I finished writing the book. Looking back, I'm glad that my call then was the U.S. is going to come out of this looking better than you think, and China is going to come out of this looking worse than you think, certainly worse than seemed likely back in June, July of 2020.
Coming back to the example of earthquakes and not knowing when the big one is going to hit on the West Coast, I mean, how much do humans not invite disasters but take risks that would make them more vulnerable to disasters?
Well, if you were an alien and all you knew about the planet Earth was the fault lines and the locations of the major cities, you would conclude that human beings are tremendously attracted to earthquakes and volcanoes, because we build an enormous number of cities in really quite dangerous places. And that's especially true in Asia, Indonesia, Japan. These are geologically dangerous places, and we have very large concentrations of population in both. I think part of what's interesting to me is that we rebuild even after a disaster has occurred. It's one thing for an unexpected eruption to destroy Pompeii, Herculaneum, and other Roman towns in the neighborhood of Vesuvius. It's another thing to keep building cities in that neighborhood and continue to build them well into the modern era.
Did you want to finish the thought about how we tend to build near volcanoes and fault lines?
I was going to say that if you think about the frequency of major earthquakes or major volcanoes, sufficiently spaced out that we forget. And a good example of this is Japan, which has a really huge problem with earthquakes through its history. But somehow when Fukushima happened, there was this failure to conceive of an earthquake large enough to create a tsunami that would be large enough to breach the walls around nuclear power stations. So here we see not so much the failure of imagination as the failure to learn from history in a systematic way. Ultimately, we do have to pay attention to what happened to our grandparents and great-grandparents. Ultimately, if we come back to the issue of wars, we struggle to imagine a world war because it's been so long. My grandfathers fought in world wars, but I didn't have to fight in any war. And I think the big challenge when we look ahead to the potential for a major conflict in our time is that we're beginning to forget what a really big war looks like. So that's another kind of danger where we suffer from a slight amnesia.
And not just an amnesia, but a different kind of affliction, for lack of a better term. You bring up a few times in the book a song from World War I that starts, "The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling." What do we learn from that song?
Well, I was very struck by this song when I first heard it as a boy, and I delved into its history when I was writing Doom. It turns out this was a parody of a Salvation Army song that the soldiers in the British Army sang in the trenches in 1916, and it goes, "The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me." And this is a fascinating illustration of the way we as individuals tend to think about disaster, which is, I'll be fine. We can get our heads around the idea of a disaster. We can sort of see the German guns or hear them, but we just struggle to imagine that the disaster will befall us. And I'm sure a great many people who fell victim to COVID over the last 18 months had a version of this in not wearing masks or not taking precautions despite having vulnerability. They were a little like those soldiers singing "the bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me." We struggle a bit with the idea that our probability of premature death has suddenly jumped, which is what, of course, happens in a pandemic. And I think that's part of the challenge for us as human beings. We're a little bit in denial about our own mortality generally. Most of us quietly assume that we'll make it to our 80s, which is not going to be the case for all of us. And most of us, I think, even then, don't quite imagine the end. As I say in the book, we've kind of made death a slightly off-limits topic compared with our medieval and early modern ancestors. And even the word death doesn't get used very much. I'm British by origin. I'm always surprised by the American tendency to say that people pass, which is a euphemism in its own right.
Yeah, I noticed that too. But so there, it would seem to indicate, though, if we don't believe that we're going to die or don't believe that we're going to die early, that there would never be a completely unified preparation for disaster.
Well, I think this is part of the problem. I mean, you can't prepare for every disaster that could possibly happen, and the cost would be onerous. And even trying to prepare for the very foreseeable disasters associated with climate change is proving difficult. We're great at holding conferences on this subject and giving speeches, but when it comes to actually reducing emissions, so far humanity is doing a pretty bad job. And so what do I conclude from that? I think that we struggle to turn visions of the apocalypse, the end of the world, into actionable policy because it just involves an upfront cost. And as soon as you turn climate discussions to the question of how you'll pay for this, you start finding it's an uphill political struggle. So I think this is the huge challenge. that democratic leaders in particular face. It's what Henry Kissinger called the problem of conjecture. It's very difficult to make an upfront sacrifice to avoid a future disaster that's quite remote. It's easier to kick the can down the road and hope the disaster won't happen. You might get lucky and it might not. But the problem is that if you're successful, if you pay those upfront costs and avoid the disaster, nobody's grateful. There's very little gratitude for disasters that don't happen. Good example. There hasn't been another 9/11, and we're coming up to the 20th anniversary. There has not been another really massive terrorist attack in the United States. Does anybody look back and say what a great job George W. Bush, or for that matter, Barack Obama and Donald Trump did? No, because we're not grateful for disasters that are averted. That means that for a politician, the payoffs are very asymmetrical, and it makes much more sense to kick the can down the road rather than to make the upfront sacrifice.
Well, it's not just a human capacity for denial and lack of imagination. In our time, too, there's this instant knee-jerk response on a couple of different levels. One, that if you're for it, I'm probably against it. Two, the idea that there's some other cause here that nobody wants to talk about. So I know I'm trying to separate egg, white, and yolk here, but are people more likely to believe wild theories now, period, or does the social media and divided media landscape cause it?
Well, it's a great question, Jeffrey. It's certainly true that in disasters, people can quickly believe some pretty crazy things. We're good at jumping to the wrong conclusions. During the Black Death in the 1340s, some people thought that it must be divine punishment, and they wandered around Europe flogging themselves. Others thought that it was the fault of the Jews, and there was a good deal of violence against Jewish communities in the 1340s until the Pope demanded that it stop. So it's not as if we don't have a track record here. I think, though, that in the 20th century, our attitudes towards disaster grew somewhat more rational. And more recently, I think we've veered back into magical thinking. And one of the arguments the book makes is that we actually tell ourselves we're more scientific than ever. We talk about the science all the time. But in reality, that often masks a certain amount of magical thinking. I do think social media has played a major part in disseminating crazy ideas about the virus, about therapies for the virus, and about vaccines. I'm sure that's made the challenge greater of bringing this pandemic under control. And in that sense, there is a continuity from The Square and the Tower, which warned of what happens if you build a networked world, and Doom, which shows that with a massive network for disinformation and misinformation, it becomes genuinely difficult to persuade people to act rationally. One reason that COVID-19 is not over is that there is such vaccine resistance in parts of the United States that we still have 28% of people unvaccinated saying they will not get vaccinated, whatever. And this is a depressing thing to contemplate, because it means that they are playing not only with their own lives and health, but potentially with those of other people. So I think we have a problem, and it's got worse. It feels as if we believe more crazy stuff than we believed about infectious disease in the 1950s or 1960s.
Let's take a call from a fellow expat, Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Neil Ferguson, the author of Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Tony, there?
Hi, Tony.
Look, I've already bought it a couple of weeks ago. I am honored to be able to speak to such an eminent historian, and indeed also the husband of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, one of surely the most courageous women in America. Regarding the pandemic, because of family connections, I have some family in Sweden, and I've been following the way they've been approaching this. And as a general question, it looks like Sweden, for example, went very much on the laissez-faire approach, and they resisted lockdowns, schools and businesses stayed open, and though their death rate is probably comparable to other similar nations, they did manage to keep their economy going. The reduction in their GDP was much less than other nations. And my question is, if America had been advised by Anders Tegnell, the epidemiologist in Sweden, or indeed your colleague Scott Atlas, or people who had signed the Great Barrington Declaration, rather than Tony Fauci, would we be in a better position today?
All right, thank you, Tony.
Tony, that's a great question. Thanks so much for calling in. Thanks for your kind words about my wife. I think we would have significantly increased the mortality numbers if we'd done that. And here's why. I think the U.S. population has a really alarmingly large number of people with comorbidities and vulnerabilities, much higher than is true of the Swedish population. I suspect your relatives would confirm that. If we'd gone down the Swedish route, yeah, we might have been able to achieve a somewhat less drastic contraction of economic activity back in the spring of 2020. But I think we would have paid for it with an even higher body count than 600,000. I know that this is a controversial issue, but it's very much the view of Nicholas Christakis, my friend and one of the great thinkers on pandemics at Yale University. So I think we probably didn't really have that option, or at least it would have been a costly one. Actually, Tony, you can put this differently. You can say that there were some parts of the United States that were Sweden. I mean, the Dakotas basically did very, very light touch restrictions. There were hardly any lockdowns in some states in the heartland. And other states went for a much more European approach, California with restrictions that were almost on a European scale. And we can see the outcomes in terms of mortality that were, you know, they were significantly different. But you kind of step back and ask yourself, what would have been the best possible policy response? And I think it wouldn't have been the Swedish response, which in the end, it didn't massively improve the economic outcomes for Sweden. And they did end up with significantly more mortality than Norway or Denmark. I think what we needed to do was look at Taiwan and South Korea, respond very early, use testing and tracing to try to contain the spread. This was also what happened in New Zealand and to an extent in Australia. Containing spread had much lower costs, both in public health and economic terms, than allowing the spread to happen and then doing lockdowns or doing lighter touch responses like the Swedes and ending up with a really pretty significant death toll.
You do bring up the figure of Cassandra, who warns of doom and is usually ignored. There are people in the book who have warned about. You mentioned earlier on the planner in 2018 who said, you know, we're really not quite ready for a pandemic in this country. I remember at least one economist who said, yeah, there's going to be a great recession if we keep doing what we're doing. What is it in the rest of us that goes, nah, can't happen?
I think it's partly that we hear too many prophecies of doom. I mean, there are some people who make a living from predicting a financial crisis every year. It's a kind of it's a business model of sorts. You'll get it right, even if it's only once in 20 years, and be fated when that happens. But we the rest of us are kind of inured to prophecies of doom. There are too many of them. This is an argument I have with Richard Clark and Arpietti, because they want Cassandras in every government department. But I think this would drive us all insane, because there would just be too many predictions of disaster. The conclusion I come to in doom is that you can't forecast a catastrophic event. You certainly can't predict its timing. You can know that a pandemic could happen, like a big earthquake, but you can't say when. So it's better, I think, to be quick on the draw, to be very quick to respond once you see it's happening, once those first tremors occur and those first red flags are flying in Wuhan. And what we've lost is that nimbleness. I think our public health bureaucracy was very sluggish. And this was also true in the UK, as Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's advisor, recently pointed out. There was a sort of paralysis January, February, into mid-March, and then panic. So we've got to improve, because rapid reaction is really the key to good disaster management. It's being quick in response, not having Cassandra-like powers of prophecy.
Just a couple seconds left for this question, which was, does a lot of this have to do with how organized the world was after World War II, that we had come together to do an important thing, and we were nimble then?
Yes. The Eisenhower administration was good at disaster because it had just waged World War II. And maybe that's a great note on which to end.
All right. Indeed, we will have to end there. Neil Ferguson has joined us once again on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about his latest book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Thank you so much for coming in once again.
Be my pleasure, Jeffrey.
All right. Take care.